Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
What do the most successful growing businesses have in common? They're working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
And welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I am Ben Boland.
Ben, we've got a listener suggestion that I cannot believe that we have not gotten to until this point in our podcast history.
Yeah, I was stunned, Scott.
Yeah, I was too. This kind of a spinoff, I guess, because this comes from a Facebook listener, Car Stuff fan. How would I say that, I guess? Facebook Car Stuff fan, audio listener, yeah. Whatever.
That's good.
Maybe.
Let's go by it. Let's get on a first name basis.
Gary.
Okay. Hey, Gary.
Gary from Facebook. And Gary says, we'd actually mentioned him in the past, I think maybe on a Nuts and Bolts episode,
mm-hmm.
but he says something in here. He says, I thought it was funny that you said that you had not seen the Ford RS200. Maybe he means on the street, or maybe he mentioned you. I'm not sure. I've seen him before, but mm-hmm. It says, I grew up in Ireland, and it's all F1 and WRC, which is World Rally Car.
Right.
Very few of them around, and I always thought that they were cool, but until I heard the 10-hour engine thing, that's when they, fell out of his favor, I guess, because remember we talked about the full engine rebuild at 10 hours.
Right, yep.
Full throttle, 10-hour engine. You know, that's the
so
maximum.
Just to catch people up who mm-hmm. haven't heard that episode, after you run those vehicles for 10 hours, you have to break down the engine and rebuild it.
Yeah, completely rebuild the engine after 10 hours of use. So
kind of a catch.
That right? is.
Kind of a con.
But then again, that's a racing engine, so that's what happens, I guess, right?
Yeah.
So mentions that, you know, there's a Lola factory entered F1 car that's in this museum there in Ireland he goes to, and there's one of these RS200s parked next to it. And those are part of a rally group that was called Group B. And so he said, you know, here's your 1,001st podcast idea. Why don't you do Group B rally cars?
Why haven't we done Group B rally cars?
That is maybe the better question. And Gary, I can't believe, looking back through our notes, that we haven't covered Group B yet. But that's a great suggestion. So that's what we're going to do today.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, we're going to do our best, because this is a subject that is rich with material.
Yes, no kidding. Gary, thank you for giving us such excellent inspiration. I guess what we're going to do is, it's like that old joke, how do you eat a whale? One bite at a time. We're going to do our best here, Scott. But let us not be remiss, my friend. If we are going to talk about Group B at all, then we need to put a little context here. We need to paint some background in the picture. We need to talk about Group A.
Yeah, that's how we start these things. Usually we go into a little bit of history,
mm-hmm.
kind of where things come from. So Group A at the time. Now, these are rally cars, and we're talking about the early 1980s.
Yeah.
And maybe even prior to that, there was a series called Group A. Now, these are rally cars at the time, International Rally Series.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fairly restrictive series, in that there were a lot of rules. They were production-derived vehicles that were limited in terms of power,
mm-hmm.
weight, technology that they could use. In fact, overall cost of the vehicle was even limited. So really, really restrictive in that, you know, these base models of the cars that they used had to be mass-produced, so they had to have at least 5,000 units per year. They all had to have four seats. But the purpose of these restrictions was to ensure that a lot of different privately owned entries into these international events could occur. You know, that people could get their hands on one of these, mm-hmm. create a rally car out of it, and then take it to competition. And then they would
have a decent shot at placing.
Exactly. And they would have a rich field of vehicles.
And then, by way of contrast.
Well, yeah, I mean, these Group A cars, they're extremely accessible, right?
Yes.
They're relatively easy for these private teams to field this entry. They're low cost.
Mm-hmm.
But man, you're already kind of
chomping at the bit.
You're leaning on the edge of the table,
yeah.
Ben. So then what happens?
Then in 1982, they introduce Group B.
Mm-hmm.
And Group B is the meaner, tougher, sibling of Group A, because Group B doesn't have near as many restrictions on the kind of technology or the design or what kind of production numbers you need. And they, I think you have to have like 200.
Yeah, it was extremely low.
Which is so small.
Yeah, for the, what do they call that? The homologation, I think is what they call that, where, and I'll probably mess up the pronunciation of that later, but homologation is, the number of production vehicles that have to match, the car that you're fielding in the competition. So.
That's a great explanation.
Yeah, that's probably the best way to do it. So they have to build 200 at least that mm-hmm. are available for public use, and they are detuned. They're detuned for the street, you know, for street
use. Sure, yeah.
However, they might build like 220, and then the additional 20 vehicles are for the rally teams, and those are the ones that, you know, are really, really
are just monsters, because in addition to that, there's no restriction on boosting at all.
Gosh, yeah, this group, when you hear about Group B, and I'll say this maybe a couple times, but they called this the monsters of rally, is what they called them.
Yeah.
And these cars were absolutely insane fast. They were amazing cars. And I remember the time we're talking about. This is a season or a rally group that started in 1983, and the whole thing only lasted until 1986, as we'll find out. But you got to picture yourself back in 1983 to just imagine how amazing these things are. Now they were introduced as a replacement for previous rally groups.
Oh yeah, group four and group five. Mm-hmm. They used to be by numbers, so that those were touring.
Yeah.
So group four was modified touring cars, and yep. I think group five was prototypes.
Yeah,
right?
the modified grand touring cars. Now examples of those
Good
would
point.
Be like if you want to see examples of the modified grand touring cars, they were the Lancia Stratos. That's a car that had a Ferrari V6 engine in it. There was also the Alpine, Renault, which was kind of like a combination effort between Alpine and Renault. They had the A110, if you want to look up one of those. These are both international groups, and you mentioned the touring prototype cars, also very cool. These Group B rally cars are what kind of, they took over these exotic series, these exotic, groups, I guess, and they combined into Group B. And, oh my gosh, as far as like, you know, the way that Group B cars were perceived initially, I mean, they absolutely dominated. They ruled all of international competition.
Yep.
This is what people focused on. This is what the fans came out for. There were 5 days of, you know, 5 day events in some cases that they were absolute tests of endurance. They were, just extremely, extremely difficult. They put the men, the machines, mm-hmm. right to the very edge of what they could handle.
Just for, by way of comparison here, just to give some examples, let's see, the winning cars in 1981 prior to the introduction of Group mm-hmm. B, they had about 250 horsepower.
Mm-hmm.
By 1986, before these cars, step out of the game, and we will talk about why that happened, these cars were racing with 500 horsepower.
Yeah, 500 horsepower in 1983 in a tiny, tiny package.
And so another example, the Lancia Delta S4 could go from 0 to 100 kilometers an hour in 2.3 seconds, wait for it, on a gravel road.
Oh, that's incredible. That's amazing to me. I read that stat, and I thought, no, there's no way. That's got to be, you know, they've transposed the numbers. There's some kind of problem there. These times, these 0 to 60 times, again, what did you say? How fast was it?
2.3 seconds.
2.3 seconds, 0 to 60, on gravel. Now imagine that. I mean, imagine going 0 to 60 in 2.3 seconds anyways on asphalt with, you know, good grip and everything,
right,
and
right.
All the right conditions.
Warm tires.
Amazing. These cars are just simply amazing. So, again, you said no restriction on turbo boost.
No.
They were extremely low weight because the series allowed for like high-tech materials. So like,
nanofiber, carbon nanofiber.
Yeah, well, plastics and things like that were allowed. You know, they had a lot of these cars had plastic bodies, as we'll find out. They used aluminum in a lot of places. I'm sure they used other lightweight materials, you know, magnesium wherever possible and all that.
Oh, Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt.
That's all right.
I just said carbon nanofiber, I think.
I think you did.
That's ridiculous. That's not, I'm sorry, people. That is not.
You're probably talking like 2013.
Yeah, I apologize. That is not at all what was being used in Group B rally cars.
But you know what? I mean, maybe that underscores this, is that this series, when you and I have watched a lot of these clips, right? These film clips from back in the 1980s, and I swear to you, like, I think, like, these cars are so fast and so agile and so well-mannered, I guess. No, that's not the way I say it. They're so ill-tempered and bad-mannered on the roads that it almost seems like it's a modern-day thing. Like, they're so far advanced for being built 30-plus years ago at this point. Well, actually, 30 years to the date, almost.
Yeah. Oh, weird. You're right.
Yeah, 1983. We're in 2013 now. Yeah. So 30 years ago, if you look at these cars, these clips of these cars, you got to imagine that's 30 years ago. The performance of these things is just incredible.
Now, before we talk about the chronology here, let's just talk a little bit more about some of the classic, amazing Group B rally cars.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, Gary mentioned the RS200, right?
Sure.
All right. So for everybody who doesn't know about the RS200, it's a beast. It's got Kevlar bodywork. That's a big thing with Group B, right?
Sure.
Mid-mounted 1.8 liter turbocharged engine, four cylinders. A guy named Brian Hart, a race tuner of some renown, put over 500 bhp in full rally spec, despite the displacement. So this is Ford's second crack at a Group B car.
Mm-hmm.
The first one they did was an Escort, an RS1700T, and it wasn't.
That was the Escort Cosworth, I believe, is what you're talking about, probably, right?
Just and
now this Escort, the Ford RS200 that we're talking about, that body was designed by Ghia, which mm-hmm. we just talked about in the Carmen Ghia episode, of course.
Yeah.
And now the plan, after 1986, and you mentioned it got up to around 500 horsepower, they had planned for another vehicle, another leap in evolution, I guess, of this thing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That would boost this thing up to between 550 and 815 horsepower was the outlook for
815?
They were searching for as high as 815 by 1987, which, as we'll find out, never came around.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Oh, such a clutch pickup, Dave.
I know, right? I was worried we'd bring back the same team.
Oh, no, I meant those blackout motorized shades. MVP of the room.
Blinds.com made it crazy affordable to replace our old blinds.
Hard to install?
No, it's easy. Even you could do it.
Nice.
I installed these and then got some for my mom, too.
What, you fly across the country to do the install?
Nope. Blinds.com can do it all. All she had to do was pick what she wanted. She talked to a design consultant for free and scheduled a professional measure and install.
Look at you, a Hall of Fame son.
Oh, I just picked the winning team. They're the number one online retailer of custom window coverings in the world.
Oh, Blinds.com is the GOAT.
The GOAT.
He shoots. He scores.
Go to Blinds.com for up to 45% off and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Go right now for up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Right, yes. And,
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but this thing was so fast. It was like 0 to 60 in 3.5 seconds, again, mm-hmm. dirt road. 0 to 100 in 7.3 seconds. And, only 200 production cars were built of the RS200, this rally car. And, you'll find that, a lot of these made their ways to museums and, privateer teams that did take them and make them into, full rally cars. But these were the detuned versions. The 200 were the detuned cars for street use, mm-hmm. supposedly for street use. So many others. Go ahead.
I got one.
I don't want to step on your toes. I've only got three or four here, but there's a lot in the series.
Okay. I also enjoy the Porsche 959.
Mm-hmm.
Was that one of yours?
Nope. I don't have info about that one.
Okay, good. So I don't want to step on your toes either. This was developed from the Porsche 911, and the 959 had ABS, four-wheel drive, six-speed transmission, onboard computers that lower the car at high speed.
Very cool.
So if we consider the time in which this was built, that's amazing.
Again, 30 years ago.
Yeah. However, the firm that was building it was Stuttgart, and they said it would take too long to build 200 examples. So that meant that rivals could get a jump on them with the car.
Interesting.
I want to mention this guy specifically. Here comes a guy you might recognize, Jackie Ickx. He's a Porsche works driver. He persuaded his employees that the Paris-Dakar would make a better showcase for the 959.
Oh.
So they took these 911s, they converted them to 959. They won the event in 1984. And then the next year, they showed up for a Group B rally with three 1959s. Two of them crashed out of the event, and as we know, Group B cars were fast, maybe a little too fast.
Yeah, they were plagued with issues with accidents and mm-hmm. and deaths. Well, I want to get to that right after this. How about that? But I want to mention just a couple of other cars that competed in the series.
Great.
And I won't go into much detail like we did with the Ford or anything like that, but there was the Lancia Delta S4. With something like 480 to 560 horsepower, depends on who you talk to about this. It was twin charged, which means it had a combined supercharger
and
a turbocharger,
which still gets me.
I mean, these again, road cars were built, but they were all wheel drive. They only weighed 1,900 pounds, so this is an extremely lightweight car that has, could be as much as 560 according to some accounts by the end of the series. There's the MG came out with a very tiny car called the Metro, which is very, very competitive in the series. It was a normally aspirated V6 engine, which is centrally mounted, and Peugeot, the 205 T16, again, a plastic body, so it had this super lightweight kind of advantage, I guess, over everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There was an Opel Manta 400, I think, that ran later in the series. By the way, my dad had an Opel Manta, a first-generation Opel Manta. He had an orange one that was here in the States, orange with a black top, really cool car. That's a car I learned how to shift on from the passenger seat. An Opel Manta. It was, cool
That's
car.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, it was a cool car. And maybe the biggest one of all, the one that we absolutely have to mention before we go into, what eventually happened to the series, the Audi Quattro S1.
Yes. Get out of my head.
This is an absolutely remarkable car. In fact, I'm going to point you at the end. When I mention, when I'm done with this, I want to point you to a video where you can see the Audi Quattro Sport in action. But this Quattro S1, just incredible bodywork for the time. I mean, it looked like a race car. It had a lot of, body fairings on it, wide body kit, that type of thing. The production was from 1985 to 1986, the model that I'm talking about, because I'm mentioning the E2. Again, it was a, It was initially a Group 4 car that Audi had entered for testing purposes, but the car was like an immediate success in the series. And so they you know, of course, went into the Group B series that we're talking about. But this Quattro, this all-wheel drive thing, this is what really led all the other competitors to develop all-wheel drive systems for their race cars, because the Quattro system that Audi was testing was just, it was kicking everybody's butt on the course.
Yes.
It was amazing.
Yep.
And you know, the original Quattro, I'm talking about the Quattros, not the Quattro system that's in like the A4, A6, all that now.
Right, yeah.
This is the car that's called the Audi Quattro.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, as a two-door front engine, all-wheel drive, turbo engine, 500 horsepower is what they were saying. There's zero turbo lag in this thing because it had what they called a recirculating air system. So there was absolutely no lag in the turbo. An inline 5-cylinder engine, which is kind of unique, of course. I mean, anytime really you're talking about a 5-cylinder, but it was a bit heavy. It was 2,600 pounds. Now compared to like the 1,900 pound, Lancia that we mentioned, you know, and other cars that were these really small compacts, this thing had to make up for it with handling, and man, did it ever. And I mentioned just briefly the YouTube video that I want to point people to.
Yeah.
If you really want to see some incredible Audi Quattro Sport footage.
And some great driving.
And some fantastic driving. This, you can go to a video and I'll tell you the exact name of it on YouTube. It's Insane Audi Quattro Sport S1 1000 Lakes Group B Rally Pure Engine Sound. It's only 2.5 minutes long, but this will give you a real taste of exactly what those cars were capable of and what they sounded like. And it's amazing. I mean, there's this fierce engine sound. And you won't believe what you see.
And the S1, just to add some stuff there, the S1 apparently, according to Ingolstadt, the engineers said that they had constructed a 1,000 horsepower prototype, but that it was pretty much impossible to drive.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Now, we mentioned, you said that they were maybe a little bit too fast, right? Now, I want to tell you that when you watch these videos, a lot of them will show some in-car footage of what the drivers are doing, and they've got co-pilots that are reading pace notes, which to me, that may be the hardest job in the world, because you're looking down at a book while you're traveling through a forest, you're traveling over a frozen lake bed, you're traveling up or down a mountain. That to me seems like maybe the most dangerous job in the world. It's reading pace notes in a Group B car. I don't know how they kept their eyes down on the pace notes, but the drivers look absolutely frantic while they're driving. I know they're controlled. I know they know what they're doing.
Sure.
But they look absolutely just, like I said, frantic when they're you know, just stabbing at the pedals and shifting and steering.
Yeah.
Things are happening so fast. The drivers said themselves, they actually are quoted saying this, that it was tough for their brain and their body to keep up with what they were seeing because things just happen so fast in these Group B cars. And they actually called in, and this is amazing. This will tell you how insane this series was. They called in between the stages, they would call in doctors, physiotherapists, health gurus to kind of go through these quick treatments for these drivers in between stages on these courses because their bodies were being punished so badly in these cars during the short amount of time that they were driving. The co-pilots and they were dealing with these physical and mental challenges, between stages. It was very, very stressful for them to drive in Group B. They were literally like threading the car through the course because of the fans, the overzealous fans that we'll talk about.
Yeah.
I promise we'll get to the fans because that's a huge part in this whole story.
Right.
But the cars were just so ridiculously, I'm going to say overpowered.
Which is something you rarely say. So if Scott Benjamin is saying these cars might have been overpowered, then I think we should take you at your word.
Well, overpowered for where they were.
Yeah. There we go. I was waiting for that asterisk, Scott. So another example, Nigel Mansell sampled a Peugeot 205 T16. He noticed it could out-accelerate his F1.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting...
Wait. Could out-accelerate his F1 car?
Yeah.
No kidding.
That's what he said.
Wow. I just find that amazing. I mean, these guys are on gravel in a car that will out-accelerate an F1 car.
I think the reason he said could, now could's a tricky word.
Yeah.
I bet maybe he meant that if it was on the same pavement.
I've seen some, not comparisons, but some people that say otherwise, but just for them to be compared in the same ballpark, I guess, you know, yeah. that for Nigel Mansell himself to say, like, these things are ridiculously fast.
And also, driver's reaction time was cut in half compared to Group A cars.
Isn't that incredible?
Which goes into our incredible thing. I want to talk a little bit about some notable drivers, but before we do, why don't we stop for a word from our sponsor?
Yeah, why not? It's a good time, I guess. I mean, you and I, we when we attend rally events, we would like to look good, right?
Yeah, who doesn't like looking good?
So we've got the sponsor, and it's Jack Threads, and it's a shopping club, which may not initially appeal to you, but something that may appeal to you is that first you can get in for free if you know us.
Yeah, we got some cachet.
And maybe the biggest draw would be that some of these items are up to 80% off.
Yeah, and these are name brands too. They're not, you know, knockoffs like some Adidas or whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, I like how you do that. You add a little S at the end there maybe and extra A at the beginning.
Yeah, why not? No one will notice, right? Well, they would notice, Jack, that these are name brand items, clothing, shoes, accessories, mm-hmm. up to 80% off. And this is stuff like Penguin,
Vans, Element, DC shoes,
Busted Tees.
Yeah.
And, but wait, you might be saying, this sounds kind of cool. It sounds like stuff I like at a price I like, but, how do I get in?
Yeah. Well, all you have to do is just, because you're a listener to the Car Stuff podcast, all you have to do to get instant access is go to jackthreads.com/carstuff. And if you sign up today, you get to skip the membership. You get to skip that whole waitlist thing. And there truly is a waitlist. That's the amazing part about this. It's like a shopping club. And because you're listening to this podcast, bypass the line.
Who likes waiting?
Yeah, no one likes waiting.
And with that in mind, without further ado, let's go into some drivers. Just real briefly, Scott, because these drivers are exceptional in a field that is already filled with exceptional mm-hmm. people.
Yeah. These guys are the top of their field. And, you know, I mean, rally car driving, that's something that's a considerable skill. I mean, there's an awful lot to this, right? And it's not easy to begin with. Once you start upping the game, once you start saying, like, we're going to take this already kind of insane sport, it was so fast and so crazy, we're going to make it even faster and even crazier. Not only are the drivers the ones that you know, kind of get excited by this, like, they're like, yeah, I'd love to participate in this. Manufacturers get excited by it because it's a world stage. Mm-hmm. It allows them to, you know, possibly, win at rallies outright, which, you know, maybe in the past they hadn't, because there's this enormous field of competitors. I mean, there's very little chance, but in Group B, it was so expensive and so costly to develop a race car for that series, because these are really, really, I mean, if you look at a Group B rally car, the information, you know, look into the specs on these things. Right. A lot of them had all-wheel drive systems when the street car didn't. A lot of them had, you know, twin superchargers and, you know, things like that.
ABS.
And the street car didn't. And all this stuff is developed for the race cars only. So to develop a car that, you know, they're only going to build 200 of and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe additional ones for the race teams, it's a very expensive sport to get into. However, they've got a much better chance at winning a championship as long as they build a championship team.
Right.
But they have a good chance of getting their name out there in this international field, I guess.
Yeah, because it's such a rarefied field.
Yeah, and the fans went crazy for this thing. I mean, it was an immediate success. It was so popular with people, and, you know, it was like kind of an unregulated thing at the time as far as crowd control. But the fans, they absolutely loved the series, but they went maybe a little bit too far.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
If you use paper, you're a human. But if you choose paper, you're a papertarian. Someone who lives a paper-based lifestyle because it has a positive impact on the planet. And also because it's the easiest choice you'll make all day. Seriously. It's as easy as reaching for boxed instead of bottled water. It's as easy as opting for beauty products that come in paper packaging. It's as easy as grabbing eggs in a cardboard container. And that's all in one trip to the grocery store, which, if we're being honest, you were planning to go to anyway. But paper isn't just an easy choice. Papertarians know that it's the smart choice, too. Because paper comes from trees, a renewable and sustainably managed resource. And paper products are designed to be recycled. In fact, when you choose products that come in paper-based packaging, those fibers can go on to be recycled up to 7 times. So why wouldn't you go papertarian? I'll wait. Learn more at howlifeunfolds.com/papertarian.
Yeah, why don't you, can you paint a picture for me on this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's not hard to do, really. If you look at any of the film clips of this whole thing, and I mentioned before that it's a lot like threading the car through the course, right? I mean, it's like threading the needle every time they drove through, because the fans, it was really these, I said, uncontrolled, but I guess it was kind of uncontrolled.
Yeah.
That the fans were uncontrolled in that they were allowed to line the field. They were allowed to line the course.
Like right up to the edge of the road, edge of the course.
And I would guess that a lot of people can picture what I'm saying, because we even see this now, today with some rally events where, you know, people will get near a certain jump or something, and it's insane how close they get. However, in the days of the Group B, these fans were so, I guess, again, overexcited, overzealous, so excited to be close to the cars that they would line the course, thousands of them, tens of thousands of fans. So they become a human wall that's on either side of the course. So instead of having, you know, any kind of runoff area,
right,
there was none at all for
just
Group B cars.
Just a wall of innocent people. Let's take a second to think about how dangerous that is with a Group B rally car. Some notable drivers, Stig Blomqvist, who we've mentioned a couple of times. Mm-hmm. He started with Saab's rally team. Mm-hmm. He has competed across the world. He's one of the guys who I almost said piloted. It almost does feel like you're piloting when we talk about this level.
Fair enough. I mean, piloted, because the ride-along person with the pace notes is called a co-pilot.
Yeah, and they're flying. They're basically flying.
Most of the time they're
flying. So he's one of the guys who took the Quattro to the 1984 driver's title.
Okay.
Over the Lancia 37. Then there's John Buffum, the most successful American rally driver. And then there is Marku Allen. We'd probably get in trouble if we didn't mention him. Mm-hmm. One of the most successful drivers of all time. 19 rounds at the World Rally Championship. He's been in and out of so many racing teams. He's worked with Lancia, Audi. He currently races for Opel, I think. And then we get to someone I wanted to mention. Henri Tovenin.
Oh, yes. Now, this is
where we take a turn.
This is a crucial player in this whole thing, because now he's a big shot driver that, you know, was through the entire series doing very well. Very young guy. I mean, he ended up, by 1986, he was 29 years old. So he was a relatively young driver, as are most of these guys at that point.
Yeah, he started with Opel. He won the 1980 RAC rally when he was 24 years old, and that's still the world record for youngest driver to win the WRC.
Very, very skilled. Now, you know, we mentioned that, you know, the crowds lined the courses, and there were some tragic events that happened along the way, and that's what really led to the downfall of this whole thing. Now, in 1986, there was a big tragedy at the Rally Portugal. Where there's, you can watch YouTube clips of these races and find, you know, exactly what happened. But, this is where a Ford RS 200 driver, just again, came over a crest of a hill, went slid off just a little bit, and went right into the crowd. I mean, again, it was just a terrible scene. Killed three spectators and injured something like 30 plus.
Yeah.
All the teams pulled out of the event after that stage. You know, there was this real dark sense that, you know, had passed over this whole event, right? Yeah. And they're down at the hospital because, you know, they're down there with the people that had been injured, and, you know, the drivers are really kind of being proactive about this and saying, like, I don't know if we want to continue with this event because there's a lot of safety issues. And Henry Toivonen, he's the one who came out as the, this is kind of oddly enough, ironic enough, that he came out as the one with the statement, in 86, at the Portugal, tragedy, that, you know, he said, here's what we're doing. This is like, he read the press statement, I guess, saying that, you know, we've decided that we're not going to, continue on with this event, because there's a lot of safety issues, not only for drivers, but also for spectators. So, you know, we're all pulling out of this thing. And, so Henry, now he's later in the 1986 season, he and his co-pilot, Sergio Cresto.
Yeah.
This is really, those two guys, they were in a horrific accident.
Mm-hmm. On May 2nd, 1986.
Yep, on the island of Corsica. And, this is a rally that they call the 10,000 Turns Rally.
Yeah, which is weird because it's actually a little bit closer to 20,000.
Yeah, it seems
turns.
Like it. Yeah,
it really is.
It's incredible. This, the scenery, I guess, the setting for this race is just amazingly tight and so many turns, and you gotta really be focused on this whole thing. Well, they had this terrible fiery crash, and of course they went down the mountainside, you know, big fireball.
In a Lancia Delta S4.
Mm-hmm, and both of them unfortunately perished in the accident, but this really was the event that really sparked the end of the Group B series, because following the crash of Henry Toivonen and Sergio Cresto in this Lancia, the race promoters, the series, FIA, all those guys got together and they said, you know what, we're going to ban this for 1987. It's just become too dangerous for drivers, too dangerous for the fans,
yeah.
Which to me seems like they could have done something about the fans, because I want to mention a little bit more about the fans, as we go here. But, again, there's a lot that led up to this. It wasn't just the two events. It wasn't just Portugal. It wasn't just, the island of Corsica.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of other deaths, driver deaths as well.
Right, yes.
Because these things were so fast and so, I guess in such tight conditions, not only because of the fans, but because of the tracks themselves. You know, they were just trying to compete on tracks that weren't ready for something that was this lightweight that has 500 plus horsepower. It's just an incredibly fast series. So you can't blame it all on one thing or the other. But the fans, again, we mentioned the uncontrolled. I want to say that when you watch these fan videos, you can watch clips of fans watching these races, which sounds crazy, but when you see what I'm talking about, you'll understand.
Yeah.
To me, Ben, and I wrote this down because I was thinking when I was looking at this, what does that look like? I've seen this before. You'll see like a hill, and you'll see a group of people in front of it, and you won't even know that there's a road there to begin with. And then suddenly a car approaches over the top of the hill, and everybody just splits. You know, it's like the parting of the sea.
Oh, weird.
And then the car comes over, you know, crests the hill at top speed, and everybody then gathers back up along behind it, and you can't tell there's a road there again. And to me, this is the way it looks. It looks like a predator in the ocean swimming through like
a school of bait fish.
Whoa. Or something, because the way that they drive through these courses, and I can't imagine how difficult this was for the drivers to deal with this every time they went on the course.
Mm-hmm.
There were literally fans directly in front of the car that would just make it out of there. I mean, barely make it, you know, off the edge of the course before their front bumper contacted them. And people are trying to get photos to the last second, or even no photos, they're just leaning out there and just, you know, for the thrill of it, I guess. So they got really, really excited.
That's just foolish to do, though.
I know. And sometimes, you know, this is the weird thing about this. Now, they stayed on the course to take these photos and get as close as possible to the cars. I kind of get that, you know, you want to be part of the event. You want to feel, you want to feel the excitement. However, if you watch some of these things, you're going to see fans that are up on hillsides where the cars are, you know, with the back end swinging around and, you know, in this dramatic, dramatic oversteer, I guess is what you'll call it, where they're steering with the back end of the car. you'll see fans like kind of slide down and almost underneath the car. And you're going to see fans that, you know, just at the last second they get that last leg as they run off the course, you know, just bring it in before the front bumper contacts them. So a lot of times these Group B cars would actually drive to kind of suit the conditions. So they would actually drive slower in order to not contact the fans on the course, and the fans are wanting them to drive faster. So it's kind of this counterproductive cycle that goes on, because these daredevil fans, they want them to go fast, they want them to be exciting, but the closer they get, the slower the drivers have to go. And, the inevitable happened a couple of times mm-hmm. where, you know, they did hit fans, or they mm-hmm. did strike, they veer off into the crowd, just because that's what happens to a race car sometimes.
In retrospect, the writing was on the wall.
And I hope I'm not, I know I'm just going overboard on, you know, the fan angle of this, but watch any of these clips of Group B.
Yeah, it needs to be emphasized.
And man, you're not going to believe the fan interaction, I guess, with the drivers. It's amazing.
Interaction is a very diplomatic word for jumping in the middle of a race.
It's, you'll see people
standing in the middle of a race.
Or running, just simply trying to get to the other side of the track. And the other thing, and I'll keep it brief, but when they're coming around the corner, it seems to me like the outside edge of that turn would be a bad place to be, because that's where the car may slide off.
Yeah.
Also, with this oversteer that I'm talking about, and they're all-wheel drive, they are throwing gravel like you wouldn't believe. I mean, they're spitting gravel mm-hmm. everywhere, and you can see the fans react to it as it hits them. I don't know what people are thinking, because that's like, I mean, it's throwing it at lens-breaking speed. You know, if you had glasses on, it's going to break your glasses.
Well, so, let's talk about something to keep it from, you know, you and I never like to end stuff on a down note.
Yeah.
And it is true that Group B kind of posed a John Henry question mm-hmm. for the drivers. You know, how evolved can we create this technology and the course, and at what threshold does it become just categorically unsafe?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when Group B was canceled, they had already had a group that was supposed to replace it, right, Scott?
Yeah, that's right. So after the 1986 season, they banned it for 1997.
And they also banned Group S.
Group S, okay. So a lot of these Group B cars went into what they call the European Rallycross Championship, which is also another FIA series.
Uh-huh.
And that group ran until about 1992. So the cars did kind of carry on in certain ways. Now, Audi also took their Quattro up to Pikes Peak, you mm-hmm. know, and they ran in events like that. And they ran it all over the place.
We had a podcast on that.
Exactly. And, you know, they developed that, and they further developed that, and they still are developing that system.
Mm-hmm.
So there was some use for these cars, you know, even after that. But, I mean, the driver and co-pilot and spectator deaths, and the cars were just so fast, and the courses were just so tight, so overcrowded, I guess, with fans. And, mm-hmm. and not only that, but, you know, additional obstacles like boulders and trees and,
sure.
You know, fences and whatever. The fans, they just showed very little or what I'll call questionable judgment, I guess. Even by today's standards, I guess. You know, they were right on the course.
These fans really got to you, man.
It just became impossible for anybody in the series, the drivers, the event organizers, mm-hmm. anybody to guarantee the safety of anybody that's attending one of those events. And, you know, as a race organizer, they just can't carry on with something like that. You know, they can't say we're gonna keep the series going. And, you know, they're talking about adding 300 more horsepower to some of these cars.
Jeez.
I mean, watch them, and you're not going to believe what 500 horsepower will do for a car. It's amazing.
And we may well see that return at some point.
I would love it. We did see it return shortly in 2012 with something called the Michelin Group B
yep.
Rally event. I think it was kind of a historic
kind of a
event.
Specialty thing.
Yeah, a little.
It's like a one-off.
Yeah, historic event, I guess.
Yeah,
I would say
historic.
They had what, five races, mm-hmm. and it was run in England. But man, there were something like 60 cars that were interested in something like this. So
yeah.
People had built their own or had you know, salvaged some of these original Group B rally cars and decided to run them, you know, collectors and things
sure,
like that
yeah.
wanted to really see them race. And, you know, there's still some excitement around this type of racing. Of course, obviously there is, you know, the World Rally Car Championship cars that are out there now.
But you're saying keep the fans in the grandstand.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. So there's a place for these, I'll tell you that. And I wish Group B could still be around. It seems to me that if they had just regulated the crowds a little better, maybe this wouldn't have happened. I know that there were other things that happened as well, a lot of driver deaths that were unrelated to crowds.
Right. That's just what I was going to say. I think that I would like to see Group B come back. I would like to see the course change,
mm-hmm.
to be honest. I know I'm being that stick in the mud by saying it, but these races are a lot better for everybody if people can survive them.
Oh, absolutely. Now, that part of that, though, is that we're 30 years on in technology, in safety technology.
Safety technology.
And these were maybe just, and I think maybe the way to say it is they were just a little too fast, a little too dangerous for 1982, or 1983, rather.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 30 years ago, it just wasn't what it, safety just wasn't what it is now, obviously, but the power was so much more than it is now. It's just it was just this bad mix, I guess, that happened at the wrong time. But I'll tell you, it's extremely exciting to watch. So there's a ton of film clips out there, a lot of documentaries you can watch, you know, hour and a half long programs that recap
the entire history,
every season that you want to go through, every race, everything that happened. There's, you know, current rally sites that you can go to, like WRC.com, for the World Rally Championship official site as it is now. There's a kind of a cool historic site called Rallying with Group B. .net, which is they display cars, they run historic rally cars, and they hold retro historic races, things like that, kind of like what we talked about with the Michelin Group B races.
Cool.
Man, Ben, there's so much about this. It's so rich in history.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only 3 years. It was only 3 years in length. That's the thing. So many advancements came out of this, and cars progressed so quickly in the way that they were developed, and some of the things, like, you know, Audi with their Quattro technology, and Lancia even completely developed a brand new four-wheel drive system for this, and turbo.
And Lancia, let it be noted, was one of the leading manufacturers.
Mm-hmm. And look at the Renaults, like Renault, the Turbo 5 that they had, that, you know, there were a couple of street cars. I saw one, you know, 25 years ago, maybe. I guess it was in the early 90s. And, I saw it on the street in Troy, Michigan. And it was just amazing. And it stands out in my mind because that's the only time I've ever seen one on the road. Renault Turbo 5.
Mm-hmm.
And cars that came from the series, you know, they're still out there. There's still street cars out there, and you can go to the museum and look at the Group B cars, for real, the ones that really raced.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe check out some of these historic events from, like, rallyingwithgroupb.net or any of the others, the Michelin Group B series. There's a lot to say about the series, and I feel like we're even now skipping over some stuff.
We're kind of doing a 101, skimming the surface.
Mm-hmm.
We hope that this introductory episode about Group B rally cars has been of interest to you. Gary, thank you again for the wonderful suggestion. I would like to hear from some people who have been lucky enough to see some Group B racing.
Mm-hmm.
I have never seen it personally in my life. I've seen it, you know, in clips and stuff. I'd like to see it in person one day. And I'd like to hear, you know what, if you're one of those fans who is standing there way closer than you should have been, we're not mad at you. We'd in fact love to hear your story.
Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, maybe even send in a couple of photos, if you can scan some of the photos from back then. You know,
or like one of the rocks that broke your glasses.
Yeah, exactly. Show us a photo of a scar from when, when a rock hit you.
That's probably a really good story, too.
But
you can find us on Facebook, you guys, if you want to let us know about that, or if you want to give us suggestions for an upcoming episode. We are all ears and gears. I don't know. That was kind of corny.
It was close.
It was all right.
Close. You got to work on it.
Yeah, you can find us at Twitter as well while I'm working on my outros, and you can send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@HowStuffWorks.com.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.